and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Professor of Veterinary Sports Medicine at Oklahoma State University, Dr. Michael Davis. His presentation, Working Dogs, From Arctic Racing to Bomb Detecting in the Afghan Desert, was recorded at the Campbell Creek Science Center on March 12th.
Well, thank you. I gave a talk at this series a few years back, and it wasn't very long after that talk that suddenly we went from doing almost entirely racing sled dogs to working dogs, military working dogs. You're going to learn how that came to be and why that actually makes a tremendous amount of sense. But you're also going to learn a little bit about exercise. And I'll preface this by saying that what you're going to learn about exercise applies every bit as much to you as it does to the dogs that I'm going to be illustrating. The numbers are perhaps a little smaller for humans, but nevertheless, the principles are all the same, and it really is a fun thing to study. So I'm the head of the Comparative Exercise Physiology Lab, and we study athletes, animal athletes of all types, horses, dogs, and humans, looking for similarities, looking for differences, and trying to improve the performance of all of them in one way or another. Each of those athletes has something to contribute to the others. It's our job to sort of figure out how they're doing what they're doing, how they could do it better, and then apply it. So, who are the world's greatest endurance athletes? Oh, the humans, the premier human events like the Tour de France, roughly 20,000 miles, or 2,000 miles rather, not 20, 2,000 miles in 23 days. Mechanically aided, I mean, there are gears on that thing, and so it is a mechanically aided thing. Ironman triathlon, roughly 140 miles, most of which is mechanically aided, in a little bit less than 18 hours. If you can do that, you're going to be at the top of the heap in terms of the current capacity for humans for endurance exercise. The premier endurance event for horses is the Tevis Cup. It's 100 miles and 6,000 foot descent in about 14 or 15 hours. Now, most people will agree that for the most part, the descent is easier than the ascent, but not entirely true. If you've ever run downhill a little bit, you know that feeling of unique pain in your legs. That's a pain that you've never felt doing anything else. It's called eccentric exercise, and we're not going to go into it too much from a physiology standpoint, but it is honest exertion. They're not just kind of free-falling. Well, I'm going to make the case that actually these dogs right now are the world's greatest endurance athletes. Roughly 1,000 miles, give or take how they lay out the trail. If you do it in 13 days, that's a pretty significant feat, except for the fact that it'll get you last place. The winning team, like this year, finished 5 days earlier. Not only did they finish 5 days earlier, they're well rested, they're ready to go again, and you're just pulling over the finish line with a very impressive 13-day record, something that humans and horses probably can't do. So, you know, 8.5 days, that's pretty impressive. That includes mandatory rests. So, you know, when you think about the actual time spent running, roughly 50-50. If any of you were paying the extra money for the little Iditarod Insider and you saw the moving average of the recorded speed, both Dallas Seavey and Ali Zirkel had a final moving average of about 7.8 miles per hour, an overall average speed of about 4.1 miles an hour. So they were running a little bit more than they were resting, but it's roughly 50-50. I do want to point out, and you'll see, you know, I don't own any of these dogs. Everything that we do is with dogs that are owned by somebody else and have another more important role to play in their lives. We have two primary research kennels right now. SP Kennel in Two Rivers, Alaska, owned by Ali Zirkel and Alan Moore. We're really, really proud of them. And they've done pretty well here in the last couple of years. I'd love to be able to say that it's because of all the research that that we've done on them. But they were doing that long before they started doing research for me. The reason I'm doing research with them is because of that, not the other way around. I wasn't able to get a picture. You'll see later on in the presentation, our other primary research kennel is Martin Boozer's Happy Trails Kennel out in Big Lake. And, you know, we were excited about this season because going into Iditarod, one or the other of our research kennels had won every single race so far this year. And we thought we were going to get a clean sweep. We were only 2 minutes shy, but 2 minutes is 2 minutes. So exercise. Exercise is, in its simplest form, converting chemical energy to mechanical energy. And it's essentially the same thing that your internal combustion engine does. It takes chemical energy in the form of gasoline, a little bit of oxygen, burns it, produces mechanical energy, you will go on down the road. When you're exercising, the fuel is different, but the basic theory behind it is the same. You're taking chemical energy and converting it to mechanical energy. Now, if this is as good as you can do, little single-cylinder lawnmower engine, you can do exercise. You're not going to do a lot of exercise. What you'd really like is the V8 that they're dropping in the new Corvettes. Now, that is the kind of chemical energy to mechanical energy that we'd love to have as athletes, and that's what we're looking to explore. But we have to talk about fuel. And for a dog, for a horse, for a human, we're essentially talking about oxygen, which we get from the atmosphere when we breathe, and some sort of carbon-carbon bond. And those are the two things that we need in order to convert, in order to generate mechanical energy. That carbon-carbon bond can come in a lot of different forms. Carbohydrates, glucose, sugar, is essentially a handful of carbon-carbon bonds that we break, we capture the energy in those bonds, we convert it to mechanical energy. Fat is just another form of carbon-carbon bonds. And we break them down just like we do glucose, slightly different enzymes, but we're grabbing that energy and turning it into mechanical energy. The more we do that, the better we exercise, period. If you don't do that very much, you don't have the energy to exercise very hard. If you do that a lot, you have a lot of energy to exercise very, very hard. You've got to get them into the muscle where it gets burned, and that's where the mechanics occur. So we got to get the fuel into the muscle. We have to have the machinery within the muscle to burn the fuel. And we have to have, if we want to produce a lot of mechanical energy, we have to have a lot of that machinery. So, you know, we've got a little fireplace over here. And we can crank that fireplace up and it'll make the room reasonably warm. If we put a fireplace like that, fill the walls of this room, and turn them all up, will it get hotter? I mean, it really is that simple. If you want to do more of this, you have to have more machinery. And the more machinery you have, If you can keep it fueled, you will do more exercise. And then the last thing you have to do is remove the waste products that came from that entire process. Now, when we're talking about waste products in our own bodies and the kind of stuff that we're doing to fuel exercise, we're talking about water, which isn't really a waste product. We have a great use for it, so we're not going to consider it waste. We're talking carbon dioxide. We are contributing to global warming, every single one of us. Every time we exhale, we don't have to worry about that being regulated, though, because we vote. And then the last piece of waste is the piece that people forget about the most, but is, in fact, the most important waste product because it's the hardest one to get rid of, and that's heat. Heat is one of the waste products of this process, and if we don't get rid of that heat, this whole thing is going to grind to a halt. So how do we know that the dogs are great athletes? Years ago, I did not do this study. Ken Hinchcliffe did this study, and I'm forever envious of him for being able to say that he did it first. But he measured how much energy the dogs burn during racing. And he came up with a figure of in the neighborhood of 12,000 calories per day. The typical human minimum diet for, 150, 160 pound human is about 2,000 calories. So the dogs are burning six times what our minimum daily requirement is, despite the fact that they weigh a third of what we do. To give you an idea of what it looks like, McDonald's says that a Big Mac is 540 calories. Dog will have to burn about 24 Big Macs each day in order to keep up with the energy expenditure that they have during racing. They also have to eat that many in order to burn them. Otherwise, they start shrinking, and they can shrink very fast if you don't keep the energy going in as fast as they're burning them. So that sort of brings us to one of the things that is unique about endurance exercise compared to other forms of exercise. Endurance exercise is by definition sustainable, which means we can't be running out of anything or accumulating anything. We have to be able to get, if we're going to burn 12,000 calories, we have to be able to get 12,000 calories through the mouth, through the gastrointestinal tract, get it absorbed, get it through the bloodstream, get it into the muscle, burn it, and then get rid of 12,000 calories worth of waste. If we can do that without anything building up, then we can do this indefinitely. But if we're not getting 12,000 calories in, if we're only getting 9, then the dog's having to use 3 in their reserve. Their reserve is not very much, and so pretty soon you start running out of gas. Or if you don't get rid of all of that heat, then you start to overheat. So the key to sustainable endurance exercise, which is really what we're talking about when we're talking about running from here to Nome, for all practical purposes, that's got to be sustainable. You have to be able to keep the fuel going, and you have to be able to keep dumping the waste. So how do they sustain exercise? This is one of the earliest studies that we did, and I'm not going to get you too carried away with scientific graphs and all, but what I want you to see is that this is a display of the amount of reserve, energy reserve, that the dog has in its muscle. If the energy reserve is going down, that means that the dog is burning more energy than it's taking in. You can't do that. It's not going to be sustainable. And so, when we did this study on the first day, the dog depleted 75% of its reserve in the first day. You can't keep doing that. You simply can't. You're going to run out. We didn't know that this was going on. This took us a couple of months to analyze all the samples. At the beginning of the second day, dogs look fine. Off we go on another run. And we did that for 4 consecutive days, 4 consecutive runs. And what we discovered was the dogs knew just as well as we did that you can't sit there and deplete your reserves and keep running. So, not having read the textbook, they just decided to stop depleting their reserves. So there. Problem solved, right? Except that this has never been shown before, and other than subsequent studies that we've done with sled dogs, it's never been shown since. Not only did they keep doing the same amount of work without having to use their reserves, but you can see in one form of the reserve, the carbohydrates stored in the muscle, they actually have the nerve to replenish that reserve while they're continuing to work. That is the definition of fatigue proof. If you can replenish your reserves while doing the exercise, you don't have to stop to replenish. You can keep going. You're fatigue proof. That's what these dogs are doing. That's what these dogs have been doing for decades. We figured out one of their secrets about 10 years ago. So we start looking at how in the world are they doing this? How are they getting that stuff into the muscle to be able to both burn it and store it at such an enormous rate? One of the things that we did, and this is where the temperament of the dogs comes in so handy. They travel. They travel a lot. They're cool with traveling. We put them in a little airline kennel, and their immediate response is to curl up and go to sleep, because that's what we do when we're on an air trip. They don't have movies, so they have no choice but to just sit there and go to sleep. So we put a catheter in their arm, and we're using it to test how fast, if we give them a little bit of glucose, how fast can they make that go into the muscle? As it turns out, they can make it go into the muscle extraordinarily fast. And in fact, the basic sled dog is 4 or 5 times better at that than all the other dogs in the world. Just as in all likelihood, as a function of breeding, we've created a breed that is very, very good at taking energy and putting it in the muscle to be burned, which makes a lot of sense. That's kind of what you would breed for if you were breeding for an athlete. But one of the interesting things that we discovered is that as a result of that enormous capacity to do that just as pre-programmed into their bodies, it doesn't train. It doesn't change when you exercise them. It doesn't change when you try to get them fit until you really, really push them. And in this particular case, untrained is September, trained is the week before Iditarod. They've had 7 months of gradually intensive aerobic training, and their ability to put energy into their muscle has not changed a bit. This particular aspect of their training, they've gotten absolutely nothing from it. Post-exercise is post-Iditarod. Okay, so now, you know, you go from 50 miles a day to 100 to 120 miles a day, and you do that on 9 consecutive days. Now you've given them a reason to actually get better at this. They had all the capacity they needed up until the point that you really started working them, and then the system needed to adapt. But up until that point, there wasn't anything happening. They were having a great time running around, but they weren't actually getting, in this particular case, more fit. This is another way of showing what happens. And this is for those of you that are actually running dogs, you might find this interesting. This is what you'll have to take my word for it, is a huge dose of sugar, an enormous dose of sugar that we give them straight into the vein, and their body immediately responds to it and says, look, we have all this sugar, we need to make it go away. First of all, and you'll see in the top curve, the amount of the concentration that you achieve in the bloodstream is much lower. It's leaving the bloodstream and going into the muscle faster than we can put it into them in some respects. It also gets all the way back to normal in about 20 minutes. So when you feed them, there's going to be another, you know, 20-minute lag or something if you feed them and they have to actually swallow it and absorb it. But if you give them a huge meal, the vast majority of that meal has not only been digested, but it's been absorbed and it's been stored in less than an hour. It's gone. I mean, they've gotten very, very good at all parts of this process. So we're focusing on how they get this stuff into the muscle. And it actually has to be transported with special transporters that they put on the surface of the muscle. And it's really useful to think about, actually thinking about this room. If we had to leave the room suddenly and in a hurry, how fast could we leave this room if there was only one door to go through? It'd take a little while. If we have five doors to go through, it takes 20% of the time. Same basic principle applies to getting stuff into the muscle. The more transporters they have, the faster they can get stuff into the muscle. And since the faster they can get it into the muscle, the faster they can burn it, the faster they can run, this is a key element for being able to exercise. So we decided we needed to look at this. Let's see how many transporters they have on their muscle cells. And as it turns out, while they get very, very good at moving it into the muscle cells, it's not due to having more transporters. To keep going with our room analogy, they didn't put in more doors. What they seem to have done is make the doors bigger. And again, this is something that has never been described before. The guy that supervised my PhD has been telling me this over and over again, and enough so that I stop asking him or stop talking to him, because it's, you know, sort of deflates your balloon. But when I call him up and say, I'm so excited because we've discovered something that nobody's ever talked about before, nobody's ever shown before. And he said, well, what do you think was going to happen? The dogs are doing something that nobody else can do. Of course it has to be different from what we're doing. If, you know, it has to be. But this is some of the stuff that we've been getting out of them. And the key to this, and the reason that, well, the reason I'm doing it is because I love working with the dogs. The reason people are paying me to do it is because when it comes to the machinery used to move this stuff into the muscle and burn it, we're not that different from the dogs. I mean, their proteins and our proteins are so similar that in a lot of cases, we wind up doing exactly the same assays and exactly the same chemicals and tests and all, and they work just as well in the dogs as they do in the humans. And so it creates the possibility that we can do this too. We have to figure out how they are making the doors wider, but it's a pretty safe assumption that we're capable of making the doors on our muscles wider. If we can just figure out how they're doing it, then we can figure out how to do it in ourselves. And so that's the same sort of thing. It goes with both carbohydrate and fat. I think most of y'all are aware that the dogs eat a lot of fat. And there's been this general belief that we're feeding them a lot of fat because that's their preferred fuel. But more and more, we're starting to come to the conclusion that it has nothing to do with it being their preferred fuel. They're equally as adept at burning anything that you put into them. And really, the only advantage to the fat is that if you're going to get 3,000 to 4,000 calories into the dog in a single meal, and their stomach's only about this big, it has to be something as dense as fat to get those calories into it. It's not that they prefer to burn fat. It's just that that's the only way you can feed them four times a day and get 12,000 calories into them. So it may not be nearly as they may not be nearly as fat dependent as we once thought. So I mentioned that Martin Boozer does some of the research with us, and this is actually a picture of Martin. sitting there with one of his dogs on the treadmill. And if you look really closely at Martin, what do you see? He's on an oxygen mask. Why is he on an oxygen mask? Because there's no oxygen in the room. We built an altitude chamber to exercise the dogs in, because while we're doing all this stuff, looking at carbohydrate and fat and how it gets into the muscle and stuff, remember there's another substrate, another fuel, the oxygen, that we also need to get into them and get it through their lungs and into their bloodstream and into the muscle at a high rate in order to support all this conversion of chemical to mechanical energy. And so we wanted to see what happens if we start taking the oxygen away. How do the dogs deal with that? So this is a room that we can take up. Well, this picture is it sitting at the equivalent of 15,000 feet. If you've been to Pikes Peak is roughly 15,000 feet at the very top, and they have a little visitor center, and you park over there in the parking lot, and it takes you about a half an hour to walk the 75 feet to the visitor center because there's not a lot of oxygen up there. We have to wear oxygen masks in there because we have to make decisions, and the people that designed the chamber and helped me operate it like to say that, well, not all decisions made at 15,000 feet are the correct ones. And I would point out to them that, have you ever been to Cancun during spring break? Not all decisions made at sea level are the correct ones either. But we wear the oxygen masks and the dogs don't. And so they're sitting there on the treadmill. And the first thing that we wanted to do is see what happened if we, how long can they exercise before they have to quit. And so we exercise them at the sea level equivalent, and then we turn the chamber on and we bring it up to 15,000 feet, and then we exercise them again. And at this point, the dogs started to really annoy us because they'd exercise longer. And we're like, no, wait a minute. They can't do that. They're supposed to exercise less, not more. But we did this for 6 weeks, and they kept exercising longer. And we couldn't figure out what was going on until we fooled them. And we did the sea level test, and then we made all the machinery hum, but we didn't turn the oxygen scrubbers on. And so the next time they went in there, it was still sea level, and they exercised even longer. And this is one of the things that sort of explains what you see on the trail. These dogs are unbelievably adaptable. If you stress them, they are capable of responding fast, to the point that a 48-hour separation between a run to fatigue at sea level and a second run to fatigue, and they nearly double their endurance in 48 hours. The dogs are unbelievably adaptable, and that's why we weren't seeing a decrease in exercise capacity during that initial altitude run, is because the decrease was being covered up by an increase in fitness that occurred at the same time. They can get fit very, very quickly. So this is what it looks like when we get them to maximum fitness and then do it, so that they can't suddenly improve their cardiovascular capacity and cover up their handicap. So we have sea level, and this is 14 miles an hour up a grade, and they're going for about 14 or 15 minutes. It's a pretty steep grade because we don't want their legs just spinning like a cartoon. It's a lot easier on them to simply increase the workload by tilting the treadmill. But after 4 hours in the altitude chamber, they're at roughly 75% of their sea level exercise capacity. So that's the true effect of taking away their oxygen, or at least taking away most of it. But then you look at 24. We leave them in the chamber for 24 hours, and they're back to sea level capacity. And if we leave them there in a little bit longer, they get even more capable. You ever wonder why the Sherpas are able to haul stuff up, including tourists, to the top of Mount Everest when we can't? They have adapted to be able to deliver oxygen when there isn't a lot to be delivered. It took them generations to develop that. It takes the dogs about 48 hours. And suddenly, not only are they back to sea level capacity, but they're actually getting better. So this is actually coming in useful here. We have a few conflicts in the world that have high altitude as part of the issue. And I want you to see this video, because keep a close eye on his tongue. The reason your tongue and their tongue and everyone's tongue is red is because there's oxygen in the bloodstream. But what good is the oxygen if it's in the bloodstream? That's not where it's supposed to be burned. It has to be in the tissues. It has to be in the muscle. That's where we actually need the oxygen. So what the dogs are doing is changing their chemistry around so that they're not retaining that limited amount of oxygen in the bloodstream. They're still getting the same amount of oxygen into the muscle. They're just not tying it up where it's really ultimately not doing any good. And so the blue, under these circumstances, is completely normal. And we just sort of had to get used to seeing it. But they do great. They're happy as clams. And to give you an idea of the oxygen level, you can't keep a match lit in the room. There's not enough oxygen in the room to keep a match lit.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Professor of Veterinary Sports Medicine at Oklahoma State University, Dr. Michael Davis. His presentation, Working Dogs, From Arctic Racing to Bomb Detecting in the Afghan Desert, was recorded at the Campbell Creek Science Center on March 12th.
So I mentioned that we were going to talk about heat, and this is the place where I will confess I don't understand dogs. I mean, you've got an animal that is massively capable of burning energy and generating metabolic heat, 12,000 calories, and one of the worst designs for getting rid of it. We can sweat. Horses can sweat. Dogs, not so much. In fact, we've equipped them with a very thick and very effective insulation in the form of their fur. So they have a real problem getting rid of this heat. They can generate it, but they can't necessarily get rid of it quite as well as us or the other major animal athlete, the horse. So that buildup of waste can become a problem. We can improve it. And this is probably one of the key areas when you're talking about any kind of athlete conditioning, but particularly these dogs, is improving the rate at which you can get rid of metabolic heat. Because you can only generate it as fast as you can dissipate it. If you generate it faster than you can dissipate it, your temperature goes up and it can't go up indefinitely. The faster you can dissipate heat, the faster you can run, essentially. They do two things. Probably the most important thing, and this is a take home for every athlete, human, horse, or dog, is if you have enough cardiovascular fitness to be able to get blood through the muscle and through whatever it is that you're using to get rid of heat, you're going to be better off. The blood is what's going to transport the heat. If you have poor cardiovascular function, you can only do one or the other. You can't do both. And so your muscle may generate heat, but if you don't have enough blood flow to get through the muscle and through the skin or the tongue or whatever, then you can't get rid of it. Cardiovascular fitness is absolutely critical. And you can spend months improving your cardiovascular fitness, and you can wipe it out in less than an hour. How do you wipe it out in less than an hour? 90% of the improvement in cardiovascular fitness is increasing the volume of blood that you can pump. If you get dehydrated, you undo that. You undo all of that work and all of that benefit in a matter of hours. You're going to see why that's so important when we start talking about bomb detection dogs. The other thing, which we don't understand nearly as much, is you can handle hotter temperatures. And we've measured, using the little radio pills that you can give to the dog, and it'll give you a little radio signal that tells you the temperature all the way in deep inside the core of the dog. They just, we just stick it in a Vienna sausage and away they go. And we've routinely measured temperatures of 108 when they're exercising. Doesn't kill them. Doesn't hurt them. They're fine. If you take your couch potato, unacclimatized, non-athletic dog, and you lock them in the car at the parking lot, and they get up to 108, they are probably going to die. It's a difference between a dog that has become acclimatized and tolerant of those temperatures and one that's not. The only place where the heat is really coming to the surface is their nose and mouth. It's one of the reasons why, even though it's better than nothing, it's not all that effective if you have an overheated dog to pour water over the top of them, because it can't get to the fur, and even if it does get to the fur, the heat's not at the skin because they don't have sweat glands, so what's the point of taking the heat to the skin? So when we're doing emergency cooling procedures on overheated dogs, we're focusing on the areas of the dog where the heat actually is accessible. And for the most part, that's going to be their faces. That's also one of the reasons why when you see the dogs stop at a checkpoint and they kind of do their little shake and then they start doing the face plant into the snow, they're trying to cool themselves. They're doing the face plant to get the snow on their face and cool themselves off. So I promised you that I'd tell you why, after all these years of doing sled dogs, I suddenly started working with explosive detection dogs. About 5 years ago, a lady named Lisa Albuquerque was working for the Marine Corps, and one of the very, very high-ranking generals in the Marine Corps had a son that was part of the deployed troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he got killed by an IED. IED stands for improvised explosive detection, or improvised explosive device. I'm getting my acronyms confused. But basically, it's a homemade bomb. And very rapidly in the Afghanistan and Iraq conflicts, IEDs became the most effective tool against our troops. So we have one of the general's sons gets killed, and at funeral service, he turns to a substantially outranking him senior officer, going from, I think, 1 star to 3 star or something, and just more or less gets in his face and says, "So what are we doing about this?" And all of a sudden, it became really, really important. Lisa came up with the idea of using Labrador retrievers to find explosives. Labrador retrievers have been bred for generations to go find things. Those things are typically feathered, and they love doing it. It's a game. If you've ever had a Labrador retriever 6 weeks old and that thing is going out and finding stuff and bringing it back to you. So why not, instead of teaching them how to go find pheasant and quail, we teach them to find explosives. And so the program basically was an enormous success. These dogs, and just as importantly, the infrastructure that has built the field trial industry, is all about teaching these dogs to operate at a distance. They're not at the end of a leash. They are turned completely loose. They are following their nose. They're listening for signals from their handler, and and they're just covering ground. Works great. One of the most effective ways of finding explosives. But they were not prepared for the magnitude of exercise stress that these dogs would undergo. The vast majority of the military working dogs are at the end of a leash. And so they're doing the same amount of work that the other end of the leash is doing. You turn them loose and suddenly they're actually fulfilling their potential as an athlete, which is substantially greater than ours. So they're doing a great job finding IEDs, but they're totally wearing out in the process. You know, a lot of the work that we've done with sled dogs has been funded by the military to really see if we could improve human fitness. But apparently they started talking. I got a call a couple of years ago. I was actually up in Fairbanks waiting for the finish of the Yukon Quest, and I'd never met Lisa before, but she calls me up and says that, you know, she's the manager of this program, and she wanted to talk to me. What, you know, I said, well, I've only got like 15 minutes, and then we're going to, you know, we're scheduled to go down to the finish of the Yukon Quest. And she asked what that was. And I said, well, it's a 1,000-mile race. All at once? Yeah, it's all at once. It's like, we want you to make our dogs like that. All right, let's go do it. So they hired me to try to improve the physical fitness and athletic performance of these dogs. This was a video that we shot. It gives you kind of the idea of how this all works.
Molly found that.
Catch what he said? Molly found that.
Yes.
Yes. Molly went and pointed it out, and they called Molly back, and then they basically destroyed it in sight. But that patrol was about to walk past that, and it was, you know, innumerable times. This dog goes out, finds it, and saves a lot of human lives. And these guys love these dogs as much as any person could ever love a dog. It's really, and you know, and it puts a lot of pressure on us to get this right, because I mean, they're really counting on us. The original program was called IED Detection Dog, IDD 1.0. I get to do IDD 2.0, which is basically redesign these dogs to make them more resilient under conditions of deployment. And so we start developing, you know, you could have almost like a little inspirational Rocky Balboa montage where we're making these dogs fit. One of them that we had, we built an environmental chamber. We could make this chamber 120 degrees, put the treadmill in there, put the dog on there, and away we go. The little helmet that you see him wearing is actually for measuring their oxygen consumption. You know, this is sort of the key measure of fitness, oxygen consumption. And most of you here have an maximal oxygen consumption probably of anywhere from 20 to 40 milliliters per kilogram per minute. Some of you might be less. Some of you might be more if you're really fit. There was a guy that won the Tour de France a bunch of times in a row. His aerobic capacity was 75 mils per kilo per minute. That's huge for humans. The best racehorses will have an oxygen consumption of about 200 mils per kilo per minute. So you're talking about 2.5 times or so, that Tour de France guy. A really well-trained Labrador Retriever can do over 300 you know, you've seen the sled dogs and they're running around, and you know that they're prone to overheating if it's not really, really cold. What do you think happens if you try to do that kind of exercise in the middle of Afghanistan in the summer, where air temperature is 120 degrees? We've stuck thermometers in the sand, and the sand temperature is 150 degrees in the sun. You know, it's a real problem, you know, getting rid of metabolic heat. It's even a bigger problem if you're not well designed to get rid of metabolic heat. And that's one of the biggest problems that we have with the dogs. I mean, they overheat. They overheat a lot. You can see, in addition to their face, their paws will shed heat. When they're really, really hot, that becomes a major exit. So one of the things that we did was develop conditioning programs that would improve their ability to dissipate heat. And we proved that those conditioning programs would work by doing a standard exercise test in a hot room, that nice little environmental chamber, and demonstrated that over the course of an 8-week carefully designed aerobic training program, the amount of heat retained by the dog during the exercise went down. They progressively got better at both picking the heat up from the muscle and taking it to their mouth to be dissipated at the same time. They had enough cardiovascular capacity to be able to do both. We also demonstrated that they became heat tolerant. So what does a dog do when it gets hot? It starts panting. Panting requires more energy than just breathing. And so you're actually generating more heat, trying to get rid of the heat. It's not, there's a net gain, but it's not much. But they're not going to expend that extra energy unless they absolutely have to. And they decide when they absolutely have to. What we found is that the dogs would allow themselves to get hotter before they'd start to pant. It just didn't bother them that much. You know, a completely unacclimatized dog will start panting at about 101. These guys were waiting until 102 and a half. We've had sled dogs at the end of the racing season that will be sitting there with a core temperature of 103 and a half and not panting. You know, it's just they've gotten so tolerant that it's just not worth the effort to hurry, let's get rid of that heat. So dogs are capable of an incredible amount of heat acclimatization. It makes our job as a veterinarian very, very challenging, because 103 and a half may be dangerous for one dog and completely normal for another dog. We can't just rely on the numbers. We have to actually read the dog, so to speak, and try to determine how much does it bother the dog to be at that temperature. We did a study with some of the explosive detection dogs where we were doing a five-day simulated patrol, and we were measuring their energy output or energy consumption during a reasonably warm or reasonably temperate period. They were burning about 4,000 calories per day. When we did this again at 20 degrees hotter, so we went from an average temperature of about 85 degrees to an average temperature of over 100, they're having to pant a lot more. Their energy expenditure went up 50%. And one of the really, really valuable things that we've been passing on to the folks that are working these dogs in the military is that means that you have to feed that dog 50% more food, depending on the temperature outside, in order to keep the dog from burning up its body mass. The manual just says feed them this much every day. And so, you know, we take them out to Afghanistan in the middle of the summer, and it's no wonder that they lose an enormous amount of weight. They're burning 50% more calories just trying to stay cool. And they can stay cool. They are successfully staying cool, but you'd better start feeding them more, and you better anticipate that you need to feed them more. About 15 years ago, I worked with a group at Stanford University that had developed a cooling system for humans. As it turns out, the palms of our hands shed an enormous amount of heat as well. And they can manage heat in a human by equipping them with cooling gloves. And you can suck a lot of heat out of an overheated human with cooling gloves. 15 years later, we're developing a system for the dogs to do exactly the same thing. That inside those pads, or inside those booties, are little water-perfused pads that are going up to the backpack, and there's ice packs in the backpack, and they're basically sucking the heat out of the dog's pads. We can cut the rate of heat accumulation in the dog in half wearing that compared to without it. We can, and the benefits to that, it means that they don't shed as much water because they're not having to, you know, every calorie that we pull out of them using this is not requiring evaporation of their body water to cool them. It's not requiring additional panting. How effective do you think a explosive detection dog is when he's panting? You know, if you all of a sudden start moving the air through the mouth instead of the nose, their detection ability goes down drastically. The longer we can keep them at a temperature where they're not panting, the more effective they are. And so these types of systems, you know, the principles are being developed from the studies that we did 10 years ago with sled dogs, and now being applied in real time to working dogs that are going to deploy 6 months from now. So, going back, what do these athletes have to teach us? Y'all have all heard Einstein's definition of insanity. Well, we have Whelan's corollary. If you're really paying close attention, Whelan is the other lead dog for SB Kennel. Keto gets all the press, but Whelan was up there next to her for most of the race. Whelan got to sleep inside too. Whelan's got this teeny little coat, but he's a goofy looking dog.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Professor of Veterinary Sports Medicine at Oklahoma State University, Dr. Michael Davis. As part of the Campbell Creek Science Center's Fireside Chat series, his presentation, Working Dogs, From Arctic Racing to Bomb Detecting in the Afghan Desert, was recorded at the Campbell Creek Science Center on March 12th and shortened for broadcast on KSKA.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Beattie Trantina. Thank you for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.